Welcome, Red Spotters. I am Alexis Soto, and I will be hosting this episode of To the Table. And I am here sitting with its creator, Mr. Peter Martinez. And as the show annoyingly dictates, we both approach this non-existent table and we exchange films, either because we think the other would like it or for no reason at all, even though some of us may not enjoy the films that we get, but who cares really? So today, the films that we viewed, I recommended the documentary film Life Itself, which is about the life of Roger Ebert, the most famous film critic in the history of film criticism, to Peter. And he recommended me the recent Shane Black classic hit.
If you want to be like hit. Kyle classic.
Of course, classic. Maybe just put an F-bomb in front of that. Maybe some crunching, too. Oops. Sorry. I don't want to get overboard here. But I'll say his latest hit, Shane Black's latest hit, The Nice Guys, starring Ryan Gosling and Russell Crowe.
Yes.
I was going to say Mark Russell, and I'm like, what the fuck is that?
Is that an actor?
I guess. I don't know. Yeah. So those were the films. So yeah. I guess
we saw them.
Yeah.
Right.
It was whatever. Shall we start with The Nice Guys?
Yes. Let's start it. All right. So the reason why I wanted you to see this is because I didn't. I had given you American Beauty. But
there was an issue because
there was issues. We weren't able to get the film to watch it.
Right. Yeah.
But Nice Guys was there, and I was like, "Well,
that'd be a nice backup."
It was a nice backup. I personally really like The Nice Guys. It's from Shane Black, of Lethal Weapon, Monster Squad, Iron Man 3, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang fame. Great writer. Mm-hmm. Great director, I was going to say good. Great director. This was a film I didn't see in theaters.
No one saw in theaters.
No one saw in theaters, which I feel so bad about because it was one of my favorite films of the year. It was just so much fun. I saw it afterwards, and it's like, should have saw it in the theaters. But it's just sort of an old-fashioned movie where it's like, it's just all about the spending time with fun characters,
mm-hmm.
and that's just kind of it.
Yeah,
and I enjoy that. And you don't see many movies like that nowadays, especially mainstream films.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured you would find it pretty entertaining.
It's almost like the reverse Dunkirk when you think about it, because
you throw in some shade at Dunkirk recently.
You know, okay. When I throw shade, like, I'm pretty clear about it.
Yeah,
but like, I don't hate the movie. In fact, I actually quite enjoyed it. But, like, it only seems to be coming up when we're talking about how a film decides to use its characters. In the previous, one of our previous shows, we talked about Cloud Atlas, and I was talking with Kyle about how he did not care for any of the characters at all.
Yeah.
And I agree that there wasn't that much put into the characters, but I still felt something for more of the characters in Cloud Atlas than I did for anybody in Dunkirk. And that may have been an issue where they're all pretty much the exact same person.
To be fair, that's been happening a lot with me with Wonder Woman. It's like, I throw some shade, but I'm like, I did like it, guys.
But did you?
I did.
It's weird, because I think at the end of the day, I ended up liking Wonder Woman more than you did.
Uh-huh.
And yet, I think I still give it more shit and don't care to apologize.
Yeah.
I don't care if I get perceived as anti-Wonder Woman. In fact, good. At least I have an original thought and opinion, unlike everybody else, about the film.
Well, now that's shade.
Well, yeah, but that's shading the sheep, not the actual film itself. So I'm not going to praise somebody who has her ego up her ass. So we're going to go ahead and move.
Nice guys. I will not tackle that.
We'll move past that. But yes, you are right. What I did like about this movie so much was like, it was the characters, and it was all about them. And like, at a certain point, you realize, first of all, I did like the plot, and I did like the story.
Can you explain
elements.
It? Because the first time I saw it, at a certain point, it's like, wait, why are we following these people? What's this have to do with the porno industry? Like, and then the automobile industry? Like,
okay, so this takes place in the late 70s, right? Yeah. So both Russell Crowe and Ryan Gosling are these PIs, mm-hmm. a la Jessica Jones, private investigators of that time.
Yeah.
And the movie starts off with them both looking for this girl named Amelia, who is somehow connected with this recent porn actress that died in a car crash. That's how it starts off with. Then they clash, they do a dick measuring contest, then they... through odd circumstances they end up being on the same side, and the whole movie is basically finding her. Then halfway through the film, when they find her, then this like out of nowhere thing comes in which it turns out that the girl is the daughter of the attorney general, in which she is involved in this corruption scandal conspiracy, and the entire time she made it turns out that they were trying to find her and kill her because this girl did a porn film that wasn't really porn. It was them
displaying evidence,
displaying the evidence of the corruption,
which I don't know why I think that's funny.
That's funny. So they're displaying the evidence. And then at that point, this becomes about taking her down and the bad guys. So it's like, it's really weird. I actually just kind of enjoyed how it just changed. Like, out of nowhere, you have these master assassins come in.
It just
like,
rolls out of control.
But you roll with it, though, because you enjoy the characters.
Because you're rolling with the characters.
Yeah.
And they kind of don't have a handle on it either.
No.
So it's just like, you just enjoy them trying to deal with it. And
it's like this thing morphed into a different thing as it was going. It's almost as if you made it up as you went along.
Well, the great thing about Shane Black is his subversion of movie tropes.
Mm-hmm.
Like
a la Iron Man 3?
You know what? I think Iron Man 3 gets more heat than it probably should.
I didn't mean that in a bad way. I meant that as like, that's what you're talking about, how people expect something and then he just twists it completely. Mm-hmm. With a big reveal. I happen to be a supporter of that because I ended up liking Ben Kingsley as Trevor Slattery. That was that was funny to me.
Yeah. No, like, no, he was a funny character, but we won't get into
that. That's the kind of trope you're talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think the best, well, maybe not the best, but the clearest example of that is the regular old trope in films where when someone's breaking into a home, they wrap up their hand, punch through the window, unlock it, and then go inside, like, you know, PI style.
Right.
And then Ryan Gosling tries that, and he immediately cuts his wrist, and he needs to go to the emergency room. Like, I just thought that was hilarious.
No, it's like, at that point, I was just thinking, is this actually happening? And I think that should have been... They established very early on, mm-hmm. he is horrible at his job.
He's not that great, no.
Like, I can think of, like, the number of times where... So, he's so bad where, like you just said, he cuts himself while trying to break into someplace. And then, when he tries to bribe someone at the bar, he tried to bribe a bartender, and then that didn't work out because he had a shotgun. And then... what was it? There was this point in the movie where, again, like, this was a point where Russell Crowe was about to ditch him because he realized he was just pulling him down. Mm-hmm. And as he was about to leave, Ryan Gosling pulls out this, like, this information about how Russell Crowe was heading to the wrong place to find her, and that actually plot points here and there.
He's it made like, it, I used my detective right. skills and I figured out exactly where
that scene
be.
Made it like seem okay, maybe he's not terrible. And then like a couple seconds later they show up and it turns out nope,
he was wrong. But like little things like that is what Shane Black has been doing like his whole career. Just to point this one out real quick, because this is the one that really made me laugh. when they arrive at that hotel, mm-hmm. in like a, in a regular film, right. that's where they have the big shootout.
Right.
They take out a couple henchmen. Yeah. You know, they find a big clue. They literally, they go up, like they're ready to go, you know, into this sort of crossfire. They immediately see someone die right when the elevator doors open. They just close them and go back down.
There's like no hesitation and like no reaction. Ryan Gosling just pushes the button.
Like, we're not doing this. But I mean, this film works because Ryan Gosling and Russell Crowe are so amazing.
Yes.
They are so much fun. This is probably the best I've seen Ryan Gosling. Because I do think Ryan Gosling is a great actor.
Great, but dynamic, though.
He always picks different roles, but I sort of feel like he sometimes falls back into just being stoic.
Okay.
And not giving much emotion.
The one where I would agree with you is in The Big Short. I thought he was just wasted. He was just basically Ryan Gosling in that movie.
Yeah. There's a couple other I can point out.
Which ones?
He did a really good job, but Drive.
Okay.
And then he kind of did the same thing in Only God Forgives, which was made by the same director.
Place Beyond the Pines.
Place Beyond the Pines.
Did you see The Ides of March?
No.
That had Philip Seymour Hoffman and George Clooney.
Oh, are you talking about when they, what's it called? It has the poster where, like, Sinners Week, and then they were...
Uh-huh.
No, I never saw it.
I might have to give you that one. I actually enjoyed that movie.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So maybe we'll... That's another movie for maybe a future.
For future.
To the table.
But I think this is the most I've seen him, like, the most dynamic I've seen him, because mm-hmm. he has really good comedic chops in this.
That's true. He's also so funny. And he's just so unlike who he is in real life.
Yeah, that he's was just kinda... this schmuck.
Right. he's a lovable schmuck. That's what it is. And it really plays off so well. His daughter.
Yes.
Great character, great child actress. You want to go ahead and lead off that?
Like, whenever I think about his daughter, I always think of when that old lady who wants him to find her dead granddaughter, and he knows she's dead.
Right.
But he needs the money, and he feels like a piece of shit, so he keeps taking her money. He gets in the car next to his daughter, and he just asks her, am I a bad person? And she's like, yeah. Just does not sugarcoat it.
No, she's straight to the point. She's no bullshit.
They have, like, a really great dynamic.
Yeah.
And that really...
And she has a lot of great material to work with, surprisingly. Yeah. I did not think she's going to be a big part of the movie.
I thought they were going to push her to the side when Russell Crowe came in. But she really stayed a constant... It was almost a trio a little bit. And I thought she really held her own against these two high caliber actors at the height of their game.
At the point where I thought they were going to push her is when Ryan Gosling and Russell Crowe go to the party. The big Hollywood party at the mansion or whatever. And then when you realize she actually was in the truck or the car the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point you realize, oh, okay. She's not going away. Mm-mm. She actually wants to be a part of this, which is... It's fun, but at the same time, there a lot of gruesome things happen here where she's like, she shouldn't be anywhere involved considering what happens.
She is sort of like a porno party.
There was a scene where she was literally watching porn, I think.
the actresses or something.
No, but like, what I liked is that she wasn't just there to have fun. She actually cared about the case and she wanted to help her dad.
This is kind of a weird comparison, but it reminds me of Inspector Gadget.
You realize who owns this network, right?
Have you seen it?
No.
Okay.
No.
Well, he has his like niece Penny that always follows him around and helps him and stuff. So that's kind of what it reminds me of.
Oh, okay.
But also Russell Crowe, which in a way he was kind of playing Russell Crowe.
Yeah.
Like this hardened, you know, know nothing kind of like no bullshit kind of guy.
Right.
But he also had like a sense of humor.
Right. Yeah.
And sort of like a code.
Mm hmm.
Like, he's a good guy, but even, like, the girl, like he had helped some young girl who the guy was stalking her or something.
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, you're short. Like, so he's not a, like a, like, oh, I'm doing this because I'm a good Samaritan.
It's his job, and he's good at his job. And he's good at his job. But it's always about the job.
He takes pride in it.
Yeah.
But there's also layers underneath.
Yeah.
Underneath them. Like, he talks about the one time he felt like a hero.
Yeah.
Like, he was talking to that with Russell Crowe, and then Russell Crowe, his connection to his daughter.
Mm-hmm.
That really helps them be more than just sort of like cartoon characters.
Yeah.
That are just, you know, dealing, getting to silly antics. It really makes them feel like fully fleshed out characters,
mm-hmm.
which really helps when shit hits the fan. And what's also great about Shane Black is it's not like in his effort to subvert a lot of tropes, he'll just up and kill someone randomly that you don't expect. So there is always a sense of danger for these characters.
Yeah, and there should be.
Yeah, there should be.
It's just one of the first scenes with Russell Crowe. I mean, the first scene with Russell Crowe and Ryan Gosling
was great.
With Russell Crowe beating the shit out of Ryan Gosling.
And he calmly just breaks his arm.
Yeah, it's like nothing. And then the next scene they all have together, also with the daughter, when she realizes he's the guy that beat up her dad, she's like, so you get paid to beat people up? And then she's like, so if I have $50, if I pay you, can you beat this friend of mine up over there? And he's like legitimately considering it, or like humoring her.
He tackled it like a business proposition. Like, okay, let's talk about this.
But also on the flip side, you do see in all of these instances, I'm glad that Ryan Gosling was not like this careless father. He did care for her, and he always tried his best to keep her out of harm's way. She just wasn't going to allow herself to be pushed aside. That's what it was. But he did care for her, and she cared for him.
Well, they cared for her, but you could tell he didn't really have the whole parenting thing down.
Of course not, no.
So
no.
She sort of had to be the adult.
Yeah, yeah.
For most of her
life.
In
a way, she's almost his equal.
Yeah.
That's
that's why I think it's such an interesting relationship.
Yeah.
Because they almost view each other as equals.
Yeah.
Even, like, the way they talk to each other.
Right, right.
But it adds to their dynamic really well.
Should we talk about the actual story? Like, at what point did it... Okay, just in general, talk about what you want to talk about then. Go ahead.
I love the way it started.
Okay.
Like, it starts with, like, this kid, like, sneaking in and stealing one of his dad's porno mags.
Man, he has, like, those parents are heavy sleepers.
Yeah.
I mean...
Plus, you know, that's very 70s.
Yeah.
This porno mags. And then it starts off with just a car ramming into the house, and then it's that same...
Yeah, it's the same porn actress. I forget the name.
It was some famous name.
Yeah.
But she ends up dying, and I'm like, this is I think it's a really great way to start it off, because first of all, sort of a dark sense of humor.
Yeah.
But also an interesting mystery. Like,
yeah.
Okay, this is where we're starting. Where does this go? As the mystery goes on, it gets kind of convoluted and pushed more and more kind of to the back.
Yeah.
As it becomes more and more about Ryan Gosling and Russell
Crowe. But it comes back later.
It does come back by the end.
Especially when the old lady comes back.
Yes.
And she tells him that she saw her daughter after like the day that she died. And they figured out that it was actually in the apartment that she lived in. And she saw her on the TV.
Mm-hmm.
And what was good about that scene is that when they're putting the pieces together about the film that Amelia made, what was kind of dark but really funny too, that while they're saying this, the grandma is just on the side, mm-hmm. and she's just realizing that her granddaughter is dead. Meanwhile, they're like solving mysteries and all that shit. And then when it cuts back to her, she's like, "So I've been listening to you guys talk, and basically what I'm gathering is, My granddaughter is dead." And then she starts crying. And then Ryan Gosling said something completely just like on the bright side or something. And
yeah.
Like,
I kind of like films that like are dark, but mm-hmm. they they treat death with a certain sense of humor. I think we're kind of similar to that.
Yeah, yeah. I agree with you.
Some people may feel we're assholes for that. I think it's just a refined sense of humor.
Well, it's kind of like in What We Do in the Shadows, because when Peter died, that was hilarious because of how they reacted, but it was also sad for them because they actually that death had meaning for them.
But I also thought it was I think a really good example for that film is when he kills that one girl. When he's on the date, Taika Waititi.
Oh.
And she's like, I want to travel the world. And he's like, oh.
And then, okay.
And then blood starts going everywhere. He put like newspaper stack. Yeah. To me, that's hilarious. A little dark, but it's never played serious enough to where it's. You always understand that they're not taking the deaths too serious.
Also, I mean, we don't get to choose what we find funny in life. It just kind of happens. Like, I know in this year when we're at movie theaters, whenever the Pitch Perfect trailer comes on for Pitch Perfect 3, whenever it comes on, there's always this part. He's laughing right now.
I don't know why. It's the funniest thing in the world to me. And it's the stupidest joke in the world.
It's not even a joke.
It's not a joke. It's when Fat Amy.
Rebel Wilson.
Rebel Wilson jumps out of the boat. And you think she's going to like land in the water. And she hits another little boat.
Really hard.
And like... That's a joke that literally anyone else I would roll their eyes at, and I completely understand, but I don't know what it is. I just... Because every other joke in that trailer, I'm like, this isn't really funny.
It's not for me.
Yeah.
And but that one landed.
That just lands for me. I do not know why.
Are you going to go see that movie?
Maybe. Just for that one joke. I'll walk out after that moment happens. No, but I think by the end of The Nice Guys, it becomes very apparent that it wasn't about this sort of investigation, because it ends with them just, even though they solve the case, the people, the necessary people that should go to jail don't.
No, they don't.
They don't. And it just kind of, it's just like, well, you know, we did what we could, but they're like, we're going to start our team, PI team,
and Nice Guys. It leaves the door open for, you know,
honestly, in a perfect world.
Yeah.
Let's say we're seeing it in a perfect world where you could get Oscar caliber actors to do television shows. I would watch a Nice Guys television show.
Hell yeah.
I think that would be perfect, because at the end of the day, like it's different investigations each week. And they kind of don't, at the end of the day, it really is just more about seeing these fun characters, really well-written characters interact week to week, and I'll watch how they grow. You know, his relationship with his daughter and their relationship to each other as these PI investigators and partners, even though they can beat the shit out of each other sometimes.
I think we're getting closer and closer to those days because of Netflix. Like, this year alone, and not this year, these past 2 months, the talent grab that they've been securing, they're stockpiling a lot of great, talented producers and writers and directors.
The two most surprising ones for me are, one, Martin Scorsese for...
The Irishman, yeah.
Which is an incredible get.
And the actors in that movie, like, you're talking about Robert De Niro, Joe Pesci, Al Pacino.
This is basically the Martin Scorsese dream team.
Right, right. I mean, if you put Leo in there at the last minute, that'd be perfect.
Have, like, a Leo cameo somewhere, that like you've done it.
Right,
you're
there.
But especially Chazelle.
Damien Chazelle,
because coming, that's not even a movie.
Right.
It's a television sort of miniseries that they're doing. And again, coming off of La La Land, that really skyrocketed him to...
Right. But also, he's coming off a Best Director win at the Academy Awards.
Wasn't it like youngest ever Best Director
win? He's the youngest ever to win Best Director, and the next thing he's doing is a Netflix TV show.
And...
That's something.
And Shane Black has just been... not appreciated at all
no.
at the box office.
No.
He just hasn't been. Get so Netflix get him.
Well, except
him
one exception, but that, I think more people credited Marvel for that. Iron Man 3.
That did make a billion.
Yeah.
It did make a billion. But he... Not since the 80s has his films really, you know, gotten the love that they deserve with, you know, some of his... with his Lethal Weapon series.
The next thing he's doing is The Predator, right?
Yeah. That, mm-hmm. Oh, I can't wait for that.
I hope it turns out good. Because, honestly, he's one of those people that... Based on everything I've read and heard, he's been consistent. I have only seen two of his movies, but that's enough for me to say, yeah,
he's a consistent guy.
Yeah.
And he's a great writer, too.
Mm-hmm.
He just knows how to write really interesting characters and really interesting scenarios and dialogue between them. What do you think? Did you like this? Was it...
I loved it.
You loved it?
Right. I loved it. I mean, the more I talk about it, the more I realized... This is a hell of a movie. And this is certainly one I wished I would have seen in theaters. You're so right. And it's so crazy to think that, like, a lot of people in our position, like, bitch and moan all day and night about how Hollywood is falling apart. And for all, you know, full disclosure, we on this podcast are of the same mind that especially as this year has, you know, undergone, it's just getting worse and worse. Not underperformed. I'm saying as the year unfolds.
Yeah.
Things like the stories get worse and worse, the situations for them get worse and worse, and we are legitimately saying that there are huge problems that they're not realizing. And while we do agree that more original films the better, the other side of the argument to that is also, like with The Nice Guys, is if you guys want original films, then why don't you bother to go see them at the box office, at the theaters, the way that that's the only way they'll make money. If Nice Guys, with the quality that it is, had it done really, really well, like Baby Driver or what Dunkirk did.
Yes.
Then at this point,
I should have had Baby Driver and Dunkirk levels.
Exactly. At this point, we would have been hearing like rumors about a sequel or a confirmation or something about like already underway. I have heard nothing about following up The Nice Guys at all.
It's not going to get a
follow-up. And it's sad because this is such a really great movie. I love it.
It's a great duo.
Yeah. But also to talk about. The final action sequence or the third act when Matt Bomer comes in here out of nowhere and he starts assassinating people. And then that big, like, extravaganza finale with, like, I love this stuff. I think when the daughter tries to surprise the officer who's a traitor, a corrupt cop, is about to shoot Russell Crowe and Ryan Gosling as they're about to retrieve the film. I love when she walks in and she thinks she has hot coffee to throw at her and it ends up just being cold coffee.
Oh, yeah. She's like, what?
And like, and then like the person is annoyed, like, what were you thinking of doing? And she's so stunned and disappointed.
Another joke with that too was I think Ryan Gosling was like, stop, you're not a killer. This isn't you. And it was either her or Russell Crowe was like, she's killed like two other people. She's like, oh yeah, she is a killer. Like, just like little stupid things like that.
Well, because he's so attracted to her.
Yeah.
That's what it is. And then to follow that up, his last ditch effort is to reach for Russell Crowe's like knife on his, like, that's his ankle knife. But then he realizes that was a dream or something. It wasn't actually there, the knife on his ankle. And he just looks so freaking ridiculous.
This was such a well-written film.
And then she just slips on the coffee and knocks herself out.
It's so ridiculous. But you... I love, like, ridiculous humor.
Yeah, me too.
But to do it right, you have to be a really good writer.
The timing.
And the timing has to be...
Right, on
so
point.
So you need to have really talented actors that understand comedy and understand, you know, when to hit their mark and how to hit it and how to say it. Overall, it's just such a well-made film.
Oh,
just,
God.
Just a fun time.
Yeah.
Your final thoughts?
I loved it. I feel bad that I didn't make more. I hope more people go out and see this because I think this is right alongside Baby Driver and Dunkirk is some of the best original works we've seen, certainly in this decade, for sure. It's a really great movie, and I loved it.
All right, you had me watch Life Itself. mm-hmm. based upon the book and life of Mr. Roger Ebert.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you want me to see this film?
I wanted you to see this because of a couple things. I like to give a variety of different things. I almost feel like I have the most pressure on me to give you guys a variety of films, considering how I've been painted as this one-dimensional taste in film. But I hope I'm surprising you guys with the movies I've been able to pull out of my ass that you haven't seen. But just to be clear, like, I am a fan of documentary films. Mm-hmm. I love the genre of films. Oh, and like
they're amazing.
It almost doesn't really matter what it is on. A good documentary is a good documentary. Mm-hmm. It really is. And what drew me to this, I think I saw it about a year ago. I really had been I've heard about it for quite a while. I think it's been out for 2 or 3 years. But I really wanted to know a lot about Roger Ebert. And what that whole craze and everything, and how he became to be this big icon, this legendary icon for the world of film criticism. And it is about that, but it's really about his whole life, the whole span of his life, where how he came up in like in the newspaper business. I think he was running for the Chicago Sun-Times mm-hmm. for most of his life, and how he was
pretty much all his life.
Yeah, all of it, like his personality, his accomplishments. The bridges he'd burn, the new friends he'd make. He was not the guy I was expecting him to be, but I ended up like loving him even more for it. And I mean, the thing about Roger Ebert, if you're not aware, he did have, as most people, unfortunately, a tragic end to the life. Like he was just like fading away, physically anyway, at the end of his life when he had that debilitating.
He had cancer, I think.
I think it was that.
That kept reappearing in mm-hmm. his jaw.
Yeah.
And eventually, oh,
yeah. The jaw
they had
just
to remove the bottom part of his jaw.
Yeah.
And put a sort of a prosthetic.
Mm-hmm.
And so starting off, when I first saw this film, I thought it was interesting that they were covering so much.
Yeah.
Of his is the end of his life.
Right. It was so much about his life in general from beginning to end, but most of this was being filmed in the final months of his life, the mm-hmm. final years of his life. And he was fully aware, like he had agreed to do this, to have somebody come into the house and film him.
He wanted them.
Right.
He said, if we're doing this, you're going to show this side.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, I think it's an amazing thing.
Yeah. You know, it's, you don't really see that happen a lot,
because I was like, oh, like why are they showing this of him? And then later on you realize it's something he wanted people to see every layer of him.
Yeah.
You know, to see what he went through, but also his massive spirit for continuing on, and it was so visible in the last few weeks and days of his life. I loved this documentary. I thought it was great. Like you, I didn't know much about Roger Ebert's life. I knew
what he was known for.
Siskel and Ebert.
Yeah.
You know, the whole film reviews. But it's just fascinating. It's always fascinating to understand
a human being.
The human being behind, you know, sort of what is the caricature that you have in your head
mm-hmm.
from just sort of absorbing him through pop culture.
Yeah.
To really get behind that and understand who he is and what he went through and what shaped him, you know, what ideas and thoughts you had about him that might have been true and might have been completely off base.
Yeah.
One of the things you see is his struggle with alcohol.
Yeah.
You didn't know about.
Nope. And it was a big struggle.
Huge struggle. His sort of just fiery relationship with Mr. Siskel.
That's putting it mildly.
To put it mildly, yes. Because I never understood that there was this sort of
rivalry?
Upper class, lower class rivalry
yeah.
between the Chicago Sun-Times, and I think it was the Chicago Tribune.
Right, yeah.
Where Siskel was. So when they asked them to be a part of it, it was like, that's kind of my enemy.
Culture shock.
Yeah, culture shock kind of thing. This is, Roger Ebert was a small town kid, you know, loved writing. He got a job at a young age, the Chicago Sun-Times, mm-hmm. and then they just sort of gave him, it's not like he wanted to be a writer for movies mm-hmm. or to review them. It's like, right. that's what they gave him.
Yeah.
He just happened to excel at that.
Mm-hmm.
And he moved up because of that. He got the Pulitzer Prize. And then he's someone who had like a very supportive, loving family, always there. Siskel came. He was an orphan.
Mm-hmm.
And he was sort of that more higher class society
yeah.
kind of guy. So,
Fraser Crane associate.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. So to see the sort of behind the scenes clashing that you never really got to see was sort of incredible.
It's kind of like Fraser Crane meets Bernie Sanders in a way.
A little bit.
Because like Roger did have a lot yeah. of fire in him in his entire life. And mm-hmm. one of the things you realize from the beginning, he's always been so rebellious at everything, like anti yeah. as many things as he can possibly be.
He wants his way.
Yeah.
And he's always been that way.
Right.
And that's something that really clashed with Siskel,
mm-hmm.
who is kind of the same way too.
Yeah.
But in sort of a slightly different way. And this love-hate relationship that they slowly grew to have over mm-hmm. time. Like, it's interesting seeing their early videos of works together, and they look so uncomfortable.
Because they hate each other.
Not like, only they hate each other, they just have no relationship.
They have no relationship, no charisma, nothing.
Nothing. They're just sort of, we saw the movie, I thought I liked it.
Mm-hmm.
Whoa, I kind of disagree. Like, nothing there.
And then they would literally fight. Like, when you see it in every other take, like, each one would lay on an extra insult based on the previous insult.
Like children.
Right.
Like the biggest children in the world. They would just lay into each other. But you go from those early movie reviews with them to the later movie reviews.
Right.
Where they have such charisma. They mm-hmm. they have you can just see the relationship they've built over these years. But they're laying into each other.
Yeah.
Like they're really letting each other have it. And they both had very, this is what I also find interesting too, they both had very controversial opinions on films.
Right.
There's so many films that Roger Ebert did not like that are considered classics,
mm-hmm.
that are considered great films. Like if we were to run down a list, we'd be like, wow, he didn't like that movie? Like, he didn't like that?
Also the same for Siskel, I'd say.
The same for Siskel, too.
Yeah.
And just the way that they would just clash with each other and their ideas of that. Like, I think they showed one of them didn't like... Oh, Roger Ebert really liked Apocalypse Now,
mm-hmm.
but Siskel
yeah,
thought it was bullshit.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Full Metal Jacket.
Uh-huh.
Roger Ebert thought Full Metal Jacket was bullshit, but Siskel really liked it.
Right, yeah.
When both are like considered these some of the best films ever made, and you see they're just crazy different opinion.
And by the way, just to appreciate the moment of that, like, what you're describing are, like, these moments in history. Because, mm-hmm. like, Siskel and Ebert was this popular show on television. Those were the origins of mainstream media commercialized film criticism. Those were the origins of what you and I are doing now, what everyone's doing on the interwebs.
Yeah.
That's how it all started.
That's where it began.
Yeah.
That's what popularized it. And it's funny. I should have, like, it's one of those things where it's kind of no shit.
Yeah.
But it's, you just never take a second to think about it. They started the whole two thumbs up thing.
Yeah.
That was them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, every time they're like, oh, every movie poster ever that had the
two thumbs up.
That was them.
That was the Rotten Tomatoes.
That was the Rotten Tomatoes back then.
Yeah.
It's like 97% on
right.
Rotten Tomatoes. Back then, it was like, if you got their approval, mm-hmm. you wanted to slap that everywhere.
That was the seal of approval.
Yeah. But what I loved is that people enjoyed listening to them and hearing and reading what they had to say.
Right.
Not necessarily because they might have agreed with them,
mm-hmm.
but because of their dynamic personalities right. and amazing ways of
Putting out their opinions. They're both dynamic individually, but when they come together, watch out. That's a different special kind of like review critique thing. It's like when you're even these days, you and I have our people that we go and look on the internet for to see what their take on things are. Not because we agree but because they're always interesting to see what they think.
There's a lot of times where me and you like we'll watch someone's review and we're like, can you believe how full of shit they are?
Right? I feel like it's almost every day.
Yeah. But then we'll go and see their review again.
Right. It's like because, without fail.
Yeah. It's also, I loved just having a peering into a lot of the actors directors he touched. They really only touched on two because it's
Martin Scorsese.
Martin Scorsese,
yeah, he was a big part of this one.
I'd never seen Martin Scorsese get emotional before.
Yeah,
but the way he said like I was almost done with
making movies.
Yeah. One of the greatest directors of all time.
Yeah.
Felt like he wasn't good enough to make movies. That should tell you something out there if you want to be a director. You should just go for it.
Colin Trevorrow.
Why do you do this?
I rescind that. That was a dick thing to do. That was unnecessary.
We're both the assholes that like that like Jurassic World. So.
Yeah. I like it a lot.
Yeah, me too. But the way he said, like, the way Siskel and Ebert, they wanted to give him an award. And the way that he brought them on when he was very young in his career, gave him an award. They're like, we believe in this guy. Like, we see something there that it's really going to blow up. And he's like, that really gave me the power to push forward and really create this amazing career that he has. But then I also love that Roger Ebert was someone who, and this has got to be incredibly difficult because he's friends with all these directors. He meets them with these actors. He doesn't pull any punches in his opinion. And you have that's a deep level of respect I have for that, because
I believe Martin also said that. Yeah. Like he also respected him very deeply because he was his friend, and yet when I made a bad movie, he would never let me forget it.
They showed like he made a bad movie, right. And Roger Ebert just tore into him.
Right, right.
And Martin Scorsese was like, "Well, come on, guy," you know. But that's a real film critic right there. And what I also love and respect is the way that they would get these smaller films that almost no one would probably watch or get any sort of
attention.
And they find them and they watch them and they love them and they really push them forward. They push these great actors forward. What's her name? Ava
DuVernay. Oh yeah. There was this a part of the film where she's one of the people who's brought on as commentators because she had a personal connection with Roger Ebert about the story when she was a little girl, and I think she met him. And what was to that again? What were they?
She had an aunt that really was a big cinephile that loved movies.
Right, right.
And her aunt had taken her to I can't remember what it was, but some movie, either awards or festival. And that's where she met Roger Ebert as a really young girl. And she took a picture, you know, doing the thumbs up.
Right.
And then when she became an adult and she tried to break it into filmmaking, she made a film, which I've never seen and I really want to see now, about this sort of this woman going through the house after losing her aunt and sort of the memories and, you know, dealing with loss. And it was a very small time film.
Right.
And she had sent him, I think, a letter like, oh, to check it out or something. And he gave it like this beautiful 4-star review. Hmm. And then he wrote about, you know, how his aunt was a big influence on him and about, you know, her as well. And I think it was something like a tale of two aunts.
Right.
Talking about
there was that. And Ava took a unique approach where she was like saying, like, out of nowhere, there was this unique connection that they both had, considering like, and she was talking about race and culture politics and how it all kind of collided because, like, back in those times especially, like, from Ava's perspective, it would be out of the norm for somebody of Roger's stature in society to be on the same side politically and economically with Ava because Roger was very pro, like, very, I would say, progressive. One of the early progressives.
I think he said he got his liberal labor movement politics from his dad.
Mm-hmm.
And it said it in the documentary.
Yeah.
He's like, if I got anything from my dad, that's what I got from my dad.
Yeah.
That's probably JFK era.
Right. Yeah. And I think he also, I don't know when exactly he got married, but he did marry.
He was 50 when he got married.
He was 50, but yeah. He married, I forget her name, but she's so sweet. But it was an interracial marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I mean, I think, was it, when was this exactly? Was it the mid-90s or was it like the 80s?
When he got married?
Yeah.
Oh,
like,
man.
At what point in time? Because if this was like around, this is like pre-2000s. Like,
I think the 1990s.
Because at that point, interracial marriage was just barely on the blip, on the radar.
1990? No.
Well, when was it legalized? The 60s or the 70s? I think it was the 70s.
Interracial marriage?
Yeah.
Legalized?
You remember, interracial marriage was not allowed.
Yeah, I know.
For a long time. I don't
think it was like one sweeping thing. I think it was like in some areas.
Right. Some either way, though, it is something like, again, that connects Ava and Roger very mm-hmm. closely that you wouldn't necessarily expect.
Yeah, and that was a beautiful thing, just watching him with his family,
mm-hmm.
which he wasn't really related by blood to any of them, but he had step children mm-hmm. and step grandchildren,
right?
That he really just came in, and they were his family,
right?
There was nothing.
They were his children.
They were his children, his right. grandchildren, and you see some of the grandchildren. Like, I remember growing up with Grandpa, mm-hmm. Grandpa Roger.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, taking walks with him, watching movies with him,
mm-hmm.
and all around, he just seemed like a guy full of spirit and life.
Yeah.
Who was a good guy,
mm-hmm.
really, and just wanted to support film and people, but someone who wasn't without his demons.
Yeah.
And who wasn't without his ego, especially. that right. was very apparent.
Yeah. I mean, one of the moments where I think you begin to realize that things are not always what they appear to be on the surface, and the movie dedicates a big part to the whole Siskel and Ebert collaboration, but especially when it gets to when it starts to turn toward the end of days of the program because of what happened with Gene Siskel, where he was diagnosed with, I believe it was, he had a brain tumor or something, mm-hmm. and I think he began pulling away. But Siskel never told Roger mm-hmm. at all about his condition. Like, I guess he didn't want him to know. And when he died, you saw how devastating that was. I mean, he was hurt that he wasn't told, but he was also, on a more fundamental level, just sad that he's gone. Because, like, you think for years and years and years, you have this guy next to your side, and you're like throwing punches at each other. You've had the most ridiculous of fights with, and yet at the same time, the entire time almost even, you couldn't bear to not have him in your life. So you begin to understand that relationship meant the world to him. It really did. And it ended on a way that was very somber and bittersweet.
And you could tell it affected him
yeah.
for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
Because his whole issue was, I don't want to hide I don't want to do what Siskel did.
Yeah.
I don't want to hide my illness from everyone. Because he probably walked away a bit bitter and angry at him.
Yeah.
Like, why would you hide this from me? You know, why wouldn't you let me in and know about this? And I think that pain sort of caused him to be like, I don't want to do this to him when it's my time. I want it to be open to everyone. I don't want to
hide away.
Yeah. So, and he doesn't.
Which is so Roger, too.
They show some pretty gruesome stuff that he has to go through.
It's unpleasant to watch.
It really is. And what's amazing is his spirit during this whole thing as well.
Yeah.
The way he just pushes and fights and always has a smile on his face. And at the end, it's like, I'm not angry. I had an awesome life. You know, this is just what happens. And you know, he goes out saying his call sign. I'll see you at the movies, you know. But just also the strength of his wife. The way, you know, you could tell how deeply she cares about him, and the way the entire fiasco, he might be strong, but for her, it's hard for her to be strong. But she's really the one just keeping him alive and keeping him going.
I love how she's not ignoring that. She's also a big part of this, too. Like,
yeah.
Her role in dealing with all of this is the most important role out of all of them. Like, she... Just imagine, I mean, she is not the one who's sick, she's not the one who's getting operated on, but at the same time, she's just, like, dedicating all her life to keeping him alive. And then at the end, when it's just, it's been a while since I've seen it, but remind me how exactly it ends. Like, he says, that's it, I'm done, I don't want this anymore, and then she's like, no. How did it end for him exactly?
What happened is he had sort of said, like, I'm ready to go. I feel it. Like,
I'm done.
Yeah. When she was gone, I think she had stepped out.
Mm-hmm.
He had signed a do not resuscitate. She wasn't there. And then I guess at one point when he was there, he started having, I don't know what it was, cardiac arrest or a seizure or something.
Yeah.
And they said, like, we can't do anything. You know, he signed this. He signed a do not resuscitate. Legally, we can't touch him. So, you know, and she's like, that's Roger. And she's like, I could have yelled and screamed and hell grabbed the defibrillators and done it myself. But I just said, okay, like, she put on his music, just
try to get so he can go out with him.
Calm. Yeah.
That's a powerful moment.
Mm-hmm.
That's, like, something I'm not even sure you could write for a movie. That just seemed to coalesce all within itself, that she, like, you could very easily see any one of us just being so angry and hurt that this was made behind your back, but at the same time, the show has got to end at some point.
And you don't have time to think. You just got to, like, okay.
Okay. If this is what you want, this is what you want. I can't be the one to make that decision for you. You already made it with or without my consultation. This is what you want. You're going to get it. It's some powerful stuff.
I think a really well-made documentary.
Mm-hmm.
I almost felt like, maybe because it was, I just thought it was really good, but I almost felt it was a little short.
Maybe, yeah. I'd say it's fairly
2 hours.
Yeah, it's fairly long.
You could have added another half an hour.
Mm-hmm.
Because you jump, you don't get too much into his early life.
Yeah,
just a little bit.
Yeah,
most of it is the Roger Ebert and Siskel Ebert stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then interwoven is present day and the past.
Right, right.
But I think you could have added another extra half hour. Maybe discuss some of his younger years and his younger writing, his relationship to his wife and how he met her, some deeper relationships with other writers, directors. I think you could have done more,
mm-hmm.
but at the same time, what they had, like, it, I don't envy the people or the director of this, because it's like, wow, like, how do you choose how to portray a man's life
while he's dying?
What stays in and what stays right. out, you know?
And how is it like for you to have your head at that moment? But what does it do to a person who has to make this film, but part of this film is filming the subject, the man, while he's dying and being there? It's like, that's deeply affecting.
It's just, it's difficult, but I really think that he, the director, I don't know who the director's name is, and he said it was like a CNN film.
I mean, we'll look it up right now.
Okay. But I thought he did a great job. I thought it was wonderfully made, a beautiful love letter to the life of Roger Ebert. Oh, and another part that I found really interesting, I didn't know he did this, but I guess it's some convention or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Every year, he would take a movie, and for about 5 hours, just completely deconstruct it.
Oh, yeah.
Like, frame
he would have his
frame.
Own panel.
Yeah, just a whole panel of just deconstructing a film. And, wow, like, what I could have given to be at one of those
right,
things.
Right.
That just sounds so fascinating to me. Just, he obviously had a gift for...
For that kind of stuff. I mean, and also what I love about this, aside from all the other important things about his life, it really does a great job of portraying how deeply he loved film. Mm-hmm. Aside from his contributions to progressing film and film criticism, you just know it with how the guy wrote and how he talked and watching those clips. He loved this almost every single part of this. He absolutely adored and loved. By the way, this also was, had a narrator. It wasn't Roger that did the voice.
Really?
It was someone who did, I guess.
The voice impersonation?
Right.
That's what I thought.
Because it couldn't have been Roger. He couldn't speak.
Yeah.
By that time. This was premiered at the Sundance Film Festival, the Cannes Film Festival. It was directed by Steve James.
Okay.
Yeah, it was based on the memoir, Life Itself, by Roger Ebert. And the production company, yeah, CNN Films. CNN Film, Film Rights, Cart McQuinn Films. Distributed by Magnolia Pictures, and so on and so forth. Yeah, I don't... Let me see here. Yeah. Let's see. It was also very important. I know it wasn't Roger Ebert that voiced it, but I'm sure it was someone that they had, and it was very good.
Yeah, he did a good job.
Very good. But it was also very important that you got to hear his voice. Maybe it wasn't actually him, but it was still in his voice. Mm-hmm. And that really helped make this so much more personal than if it was somebody else just narrating this. That it was a brilliant choice to do that.
And documentaries, at the end of the day, are more... They aren't just throwing facts up on screen and, you know, old pictures and video and stuff like that. You're telling a narrative. You're telling a story. And the way they really just captured his life at the same time capturing his death.
Yeah.
I thought was just very well done. And, you know, overall... A really, really beautiful love letter to the life of this amazing character, Roger Ebert.
Wait a minute.
What's up?
No.
What? What's going down?
This is just so incredible.
What?
It's really hard to believe. I'm in shock, everybody, just reading this and finding out who was the voice.
Who was the voice?
For Roger Ebert. Steven Stanton. Steven Stanton of Star Wars fame. Steven Stanton, who did the voices of Grand Moff Tarkin in the Clone Wars and Rebels series. He voiced the Alec Guinness Obi-Wan. He voiced Admiral Raddus in Rogue One. He's done so many voices and voice work for Lucasfilm Animation and for Lucasfilm itself. Most notably, he did the Alec Guinness version of Obi-Wan on the show, which was very, very good. Steven Stanton, it says here.
Oh, so they just straight up got
a voice actor.
Well, and, yeah, that's
and
good.
A damn good one at that. Mm. Damn, and he really... It was... like, Stephen Stanton is really, like, more and more, like, being one of the most, one of the more noticed voice actors of our time, because he really, like, it's almost like Day and Night, not Day and Night, but it's almost identical to what the actual person was. Like, for, I mean, I was wondering, I'm sure as you were, throughout the film, who was voicing this? Like, because
For a second, I had thought maybe this was, like, from the audiobook,
mm-hmm.
but I wasn't sure when the book came out, if it was before or after he had lost his voice.
Yeah.
Because they had taken excerpts from the book.
Mm-hmm. I think they did, yeah.
So, but then
maybe
after
they
a while,
mixed and matched, who knows?
No, I think they just got a voice actor. But he sounded just like him. I think it worked really well. Yeah, overall, to wrap it up, incredibly well-made documentary.
No, wait, I just have to interrupt you.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry. Because, like, it says here, like, the highly respected voice actor artist Stephen Stanton, the voice of Roger Ebert in life itself. Just to confirm that, which is just mind-blowing. I'm sorry. I'm just...
You're really loving this.
Yeah. Go ahead, continue.
I liked it.
Why can't we get past that?
It's we like, will dude, never like, get past
do
it.
Do we want to trademark that? Like, we didn't even come up with it.
TM. Just buy it right from under Alexis Mer. No. Like I've said this past few times, beautiful love letter to the life of Roger Ebert. And some good insight into things I had not previously known.
Mm-hmm.
And
one of the best documentaries I've seen ever. It was so well made.
I think it was really well done.
I loved it. Well, I guess that's it.
Yes.
All right, then. Well, I'm very glad, Peter, that you once again enjoyed a film I recommended for you. I think, I don't know, at some point we're going to have to do an actual score of who's enjoying the most films that the other person has given them.
Let me tell you this right here.
Oh God.
This show is not about who can get the most liked films out of the other.
Oh, okay.
That's not what it's about, because
and you speak as the creator of this program.
Sure, yeah. The whole point is to get us to open up to different kinds of film,
mm-hmm.
that we probably wouldn't have
right.
on our own.
Mm-hmm.
So far, I have tried mm-hmm. to get films that I think you and Kyle would appreciate.
Right.
But pretty soon, I'm going to start throwing out some films where, yeah, you guys might not like it, but I think it's good to open you up to this mm-hmm. sort of film. And there might be some films where I'm like, this is a complete piece of shit. Someone watch this with me.
Well, maybe
The
Inhumans audio commentary coming to Red Spotlight Entertainment. Red Spotlight. Completely original thought by Kyle Lara. He promised this to us. So
I think he said if we do anything
right.
on the show to make sure that it's the audio commentary
for the first two episodes of The Inhumans.
Yes. He don't worry. He is 100% promising to this to you guys. He 100% cannot go back on it. It was a blood oath. It's done.
I guess we'll just have to watch him try.
Yeah. Can't go back.
You were saying?
It's not... This thing isn't about... Because I know you have an issue with seeing film, being forced to see films.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been trying to give you films that you'd probably like. But I might try and ease in one where it's like...
Well, I'll say, with all fairness to everybody, all the films that I've been given, whether I've been yours or Kyle's, I've enjoyed. Mm-hmm. And so far, if I'm remembering correctly, I really loved Pan's Labyrinth and The Nice mm-hmm. Guys the best. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed What We Do in the Shadows. I enjoyed Face Off. Watch out for that one. That'll be a doozy.
Yeah.
For what it was, anyway. I enjoyed... what was the other one? It was... I loved Big Fish. So yeah, you see, like, these are movies I wouldn't ordinarily go out of my way to see. Mm-hmm. But I have to say, for the most part, I've been thoroughly enjoyed, and some exceptions even loved the films that I've been given. So I don't know about you, but I'm enjoying myself thoroughly.
I am as well.
That's so great to hear. Well, guys, thank you so much for tuning in and listening to this edition of or this episode of To the Table. Also, keep in mind that we will have episodes of To the Table every Wednesday and every Friday, unless otherwise notified. Also, on Saturdays, we occasionally, those are the days for audio commentaries. The most recent audio commentary we have is of Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Back, / Peter Martinez's favorite audio commentary of the decade.
Definitely check it out. Nom, nom, nom. If you love hearing people munch on food, this is the audio commentary for you.
And also, again, as a reminder, we have our main Red Spotcast every Sunday on Spotcast Sundays.
We got a good one coming up.
We have a very good one coming up with, I think it's number 64, which we're going to be talking about the big news once again with Star Wars and Colin Trevorrow, the box office, MoviePass, Justice League, all the...
And I think we're obligated at this point to shit on Inhumans every chance we get.
You know what? I agree with you 100%. We have to react every week to the Inhumans, yes. Even if it takes 2 or 3 minutes.
Even if it's like a year or two down the road.
Right.
Or just like, we're completely over the show. We just...
Right.
Even if it's for a minute or two, we need to throw it in there and how terrible that show
is. Because it's not like any of us is reveling in the joy of being right about this show.
I mean... You'd have to be a real asshole to be like that. We're obviously not like that.
Yep. That I honestly couldn't have said it better myself. And make sure to stay tuned for future episodes of To the Table and keep it here on Red Spala Entertainment. Also, if you enjoyed the show, if you had any thoughts, if you agreed or disagreed with anything Peter and I had to say, by all means, you're more than welcome to leave a comment, to subscribe, obviously, for more shows and podcasts. And hey, if you actually have something you want us to discuss or talk about, by all means, let us know on all of our social media. Red Spotlight on Twitter, on Instagram. Well, not on Twitter. You can follow Kyle. On Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, but mostly where you'll find us at podcast.com and iTunes if you are here. And yeah, thank you so much for listening. Thank you, Peter, for being here. Always a pleasure talking to you. And isn't it so much better that we're doing this in the dead of night than in the horrible, disgusting, vomit-inducing that is the morning hours. So, by the way, that's shade. I am Alexis Soto. It has been a great privilege and distinction to host this show once again. And make sure you keep watching this. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.